I have just returned from Comerica Park, where, quite honestly, I was not tempted at all to stay and broadcast the first part of the program from my seats there in Section 120. Right now, the Tigers are down by 6 runs, 8-2. It was 4-1 when I left. I am I insist, my friends, that I am not a fair-weather baseball fan. But I love this program more than I love the Tigers. I would still be sitting there in the stands, no doubt, if I had not had to leave to get here. But it does not look, unless the Tigers get a miracle in the bottom of the ninth inning, it does not look like they are going to clinch the division today. Welcome into the Paul Edwards program all across southeastern Michigan, northwest Ohio, and parts of Ontario, Canada, here in the Center for the Study of God and Culture. Much to talk about today, including the Rivka Berry case that just does not seem to go away. I read a report about this earlier that, and I like the way this writer characterized it, the Rivka Berry case has now reached Elian Gonzalez proportions. Of course, Elian Gonzalez, the young Cuban boy, washed ashore after the little boat or whatever it was capsized, killing his mother, I think, and he ends up living with his family. And I think it was Janet Reno that ended up using the ATF to burst into his uncle's home in Florida, snatch the boy, and return him to Cuba. I don't know that it's getting that far yet, the Rivka Berry case. And if you don't know what we're talking about, this is the young girl, 17 years old, from Columbus, Ohio, who, she's characterized as a runaway. She left home because she feared for her life, is what she said. Although now there are the police in the matter are speaking and saying that at no time is there any evidence that at any time there is. Let me back up and say that again. There is no evidence that at any time young Rivka Berry was threatened by her parents. This raises a very serious question for you and I as evangelical Christians who value parental authority and parental rights. I said this from the very beginning. As concerned as I am for this young girl's safety, by the way, she's now in Florida. She has been remanded to the custody of these pastors, a pastor and his wife, who are both pastors of this Christian center down there. A Florida judge several weeks ago had remanded her to the custody of these people who she met online. You know, normally, number one, Christians support parental rights. And number two, they're very, very skeptical about anybody you might meet online. Unless, of course, it's eHarmony and they're working it all out for you. But just to meet somebody online and they become your best buddy. And this young girl, I mean, the facts in the case make it clear. This young girl, these two pastors at this church in Florida, encouraged her to leave her parents and to come there. And she's now in their custody. I said from the very beginning that this seemed to fly in the face of the evangelical position that parents have authority over their children. Now you've got police reports coming out that say our investigation indicates that these two Muslim parents never threatened their daughter, never punished their daughter, never hurt their daughter. And it seems as if that their daughter simply was encouraged by these two pastors to leave and to come to Florida, and that they would take her in. Now, Craig McCarthy is an Orlando-based attorney who is also an evangelical Christian. He is Rivka Berry's mother's attorney, at least he was until September the 3rd. And according to a report filed at Christianity Today, contrary to those who have mobilized around Rivka's cause, McCarthy believes her Sri Lankan parents are in the right. McCarthy is, quote, happy that the child knows Jesus, end quote, but he is concerned that, quote, many Christian conservatives have allowed themselves to adopt a narrative and thus reach conclusions prematurely, end quote, to the extent that their evangelical zeal has led them to spread false information. The core of his message, quote, please recognize that the Lord is not so powerless as to need people to hide information, to embellish facts, or to give false witness in order to advance Christ's kingdom, end quote. What do you think of this? 866-423-WLQV, 866-423-9578. You have a 17-year-old girl. She won't be 18 for another 11 months. 17 years old. She's in a Muslim family, predominantly Muslim family. At least her mom and dad are Muslim. And she converts to Christianity. And she says that her parents threatened her, although investigations indicate that there is no threat. She has become the poster child for potential honor killing in the United States of America. Not that honor killing doesn't take place here. It has taken place here. There's hardcore facts to support the fact that that Muslims have killed their own daughters for honor killings. I don't know that there's been one directly related to a conversion to Christianity, but for other reasons. And this young girl says that she feared for her life, that her father was going to commit an honor killing. I said from the very beginning of this thing, when it all blew up about 3 months ago, don't we as evangelical Christians value parental rights? Or does parental authority only apply to evangelical Christian parents? Does a Muslim father not have the right to control and to even this may be a too strong a word, but to dictate the religious faith and practice of his own children? We were outraged, weren't we, when that federal judge ruled against homeschool parents who said, you've been too strict on your daughter and she's not really living in the real world and you're requiring too much of her in terms of religious faith. And he ordered that girl to be placed in a public school against her parents' wishes. Evangelical Christians are outraged by that. What is the difference between that and a federal judge down in Florida who has control of Rivka Berry's case, saying to her parents up in Columbus, Ohio, you can't have your daughter, you can't raise your daughter the way you want. You know, if your daughter wants to be a Christian, she's 17 years old, she's not yet an adult, but she has the right to make that decision. You know, a couple of days ago, we were talking about the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, and this certainly smacks of that, doesn't it? That children now have the right to go against their parents on religious issues. So how is that different? 866-423-WLQV, 866-423-9578. What is the difference? I mean, we're all outraged as evangelical Christians that a judge would order a homeschooled girl to be placed in the public schools because he felt like the parents weren't properly raising her. What's the difference in that and a federal judge ruling against the parents in this case? Why are evangelicals, for the most part, supporting Rivka Berry against her parents while at the same time not supporting this judge by ordering her to do something that her parents support? Is there a double standard here among evangelical Christians? 866-423-WLQV, 866-423-9578. Down in, I think this is down in Texas, some cheerleaders are in some hot water because they during football season in high school, the cheerleaders will make these paper banners. You know, it kind of looks like, the long table paper, and they'll write sayings on them, and they'll hold them out in front of the football team as they bust through the paper as the team is being introduced. Well, some cheerleaders down in a local school district, the Lakeview Fort Oglethorpe High School, have been banned from displaying signs with Bible verses urging fans and players, quote, to commit to the Lord and to take courage and do it. The banners, the paper ones that football players crash through at the beginning of games, have been common sights in the school's football stadium since 2003. According to local youth minister Brad Scott, the cheerleaders are not trying to push a religious cause to shove religion down someone's throat. The cheerleaders are just using scripture to show motivation and inspiration to the players and fans. But Marissa Brower, who's a spokesperson for the Catoosa County Schools, said a Fort Oglethorpe resident lodged a verbal complaint to the superintendent of schools saying that the display of a Bible verse on the football field is a violation of federal law. Oh, my goodness. 866-423-WLQV, 866-423-9578. A school system statement released Monday said the message constitutes, quote, a violation of the First Amendment of the Constitution for signs with Bible verses to be displayed on the football field. How is that a violation of the First Amendment of the Constitution? It seems to me the banning of the signs would be a violation of the First Amendment right to free expression. Brad Scott, who's the youth minister, said the ban prompted a rally for the cheerleaders outside the Chick-fil-A restaurant. That's an appropriate place. I mean, Chick-fil-A is a place of worship for most people like me who don't have an opportunity to get to one very often. 866-423-WLQV. Rivka Berry is what we're talking about right now. This young, formerly Muslim, now converted to Christianity, 17 years old, runs away from home, Columbus, Ohio, saying her father threatened to harm her. No evidence, according to police reports, that that's the case. Why are evangelicals so quick to support this young woman against her parents, while at the same time willing to support another young woman, the homeschooled girl who's been forced to not do what her parents say? Is there a double standard among evangelical Christians? 866-423-WLQV. You can also instant message me in studio at the website at godandculture.com. Keith in Southfield, thanks for calling, Keith. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing, Paul?
I'm good, thanks.
That's good. I think the major difference is that the girl is fearful for her life as opposed to someone who's just being forced to go to public school. So, I mean, she's 17 years old. I mean, she's not legally grown, but in essence, she really is grown. At 17, you can join the armed services with your parents' permission. And I don't think she would have really fled all the way to Florida if she were not fearful for her life. I mean, if someone was trying to say that, you know, because I converted to Christianity or to a different religion, I was going to kill you. If it's your parents, I think you would believe them. You know what I'm saying? I don't think she was making it up. And as far as someone being forced to go to public school, I think you have to take into account what does the child want to do at any age. You know, if they're old enough to answer for themselves, I think that the child should have a say-so in what's going on with their lives to a certain extent. And that's my comment, Paul.
Keith, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much. The thing is this the homeschooled student didn't have a choice. The homeschooled student certainly wanted to maintain her being educated at home, and the judge didn't take that into consideration. He just he forcibly placed her in a public school setting. All the police reports indicate on the Rivka Berry case that there is no evidence whatsoever that she's ever been abused or ever threatened by her parents. None whatsoever. And if you and I as evangelical Christians believe in parental authority and the right of parents to raise their children in the way they seem fit, are we now suggesting that Muslim parents, because they adhere to a faith which we vehemently disagree with, that's a given, but merely because we disagree with it, we would say it's okay for Rivka Berry not to listen, not to obey her parents? I guess it boils down to this. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. How does that apply to Rivka Berry? Rivka Berry now professes to be a Christian and a follower of Jesus Christ. She is in the Lord. Should she not be obeying her parents regardless of their religious faith? If she wants to honor Jesus, should she not be obedient to her parents and go home and submit herself to them? They have said, the parents have said, we allowed Rivka to read the Christian New Testament for a year before she left home. We knew she was reading the Bible. We allowed this to happen, and we will continue to allow her to explore the Christian faith if that's what she wants to do. This is what they are on record as saying. Should not Rivka then, if she is truly a follower of Jesus Christ, do what Ephesians 6:1 says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right? Or does Rivka only have to obey her parents if they are Christian, if they are being obedient to Jesus Christ? Do you think the word of God gives Rivka an out and permission to disobey her parents and to run away from her parents and to join herself to these pastors down there in Florida? 866-423-WLQV, 866-423-9578. Chris in Sterling Heights. Welcome, Chris.
Yes. It depends, I guess, on who you believe, her parents or Rivka.
Well, yeah, I guess it does. But, I mean, the police reports, Chris, say that there's no reason not to believe the parents. They insist they're not going to hurt Rivka, and they just want their daughter back.
And Peter said to the Sanhedrin, then we ought to obey God rather than man.
Yeah? How does that apply to this case?
Rivka is obeying God by being a Christian instead of a Muslim.
Well, and I understand that, but she's disobeying God when God clearly says, children, obey your parents.
Well, I don't know enough about the case, but I hate to call her a liar when she fled all the way to Florida in fear of her life.
Yeah, and certainly, Chris, that holds some weight. I get that, and I certainly wouldn't want to call her a liar either. Thanks for the call. 17 minutes after the hour here on the Paul Edwards program, the typhoon in the Philippines has devastated the Bible League warehouse there. You've heard me talking about it. We need to help replace 90,000 Bibles. Our goal by tomorrow is to send 10,000 Bibles to Southeast Asia. We're at 5,500 right now. We've got a long way to go to get to 10,000. And I'm hoping we can get to 6,000 Bibles today. It's very simple to get there. 20 listeners making a one-time gift of $80 is 400 Bibles, will be nearly to 6,000 Bibles. The number 1-800-YES-WORD, 1-800-937-9673. You can also give securely online at the website at godandculture.com. We are so close, just a little over halfway to our goal of 10,000 Bibles. And right now, if you go to the website at godandculture.com, you can see the images of those books, those cases of Bibles floating in water as a result of last weekend's typhoon that has killed more than 200 people and left many, many people homeless. Bible League is on the scene with humanitarian aid, but we also need to replace these Bibles. Would you help us do that? An $80 gift sends 20 Bibles. You get 20 listeners, that's 400 Bibles. But until tomorrow, there's a dollar-for-dollar match in place. That's 800 Bibles if you'll make an $80 gift. 1-800-YES-WORD, 1-800-937-9673. And then the rest of us, $4. That's all I'm asking for. A simple $4 gift, especially if you've never given to Bible League before. Just call and make the $4 gift. 1-800-YES-WORD.
Yeah, my name is Dave Christensen. Andy Willoughby's three-step plan is just a great business opportunity that anyone can do. Like the simplicity of the plan, using the pre-recorded messages to do all the work is easy. It just makes doing the business very simple. It's made me become more aware of how nice it is to have a business in my home. Doing business at home is getting us away from the TV more often and spending more time together doing something that's fun to do as a husband and wife. I see us no longer living on Get By Boulevard. The amount of income that you can receive, and this forces my future to change. Thanks to Andy Willoughby's three-step plan, my family and myself, our finances are changing to the better, and we see a bright future in our lives.
Hi, how in the world are you anyway? I'm Andy Willoughby. Go to threestepplan.com or call 800-305-5482. 800-305-5482.
Thank you. No one likes to hear that sound, but because cold weather is coming, so will new demands on your vehicle. The change in weather will test your battery and your alternator charging system with those cold weather starts. If your car is a 2005 or older, you're at the life expectancy for the battery. It would be wise to have it tested before winter hits. Another concern is to check or replace the antifreeze with a thorough radiator heater core coolant flush. We will also check the radiator and heater hoses, plus the belts and tires. Be ready for winter this year and let Master Auto help. 313-532-2500. Master Auto is located on 7 Mile and Inkster in Redford. Don't forget that modern vehicles need tune-ups once they hit 80,000 miles or the 5-year mark. Bob, Greg, or Tina will be happy to politely assist you with your automotive needs. Master Auto. Price, quality, service. 313-532-2500.
Are your kids disrespectful and defiant? Mine were too. My name is Geraldine Lewis. My kids fought with me constantly. They threw things and slammed doors when I told them no. One day, my husband heard an ad on the radio for James Lehman's Total Transformation. We ordered it and the behavior changed immediately. Our kids are calmer and more respectful now. There's no more arguing and screaming, all because we know how to handle them now. Even their teachers can't believe the difference. Before this program, we couldn't even go to restaurants without an outburst. Now, we go out to eat and even took our first family vacation, and it was great. When I told James Lehman about my family, he asked me to be a spokesperson and share our story. I agreed, because if one family can turn around the way we did with the Total Transformation, it's worth it.
Call now and get How to Turn Your Child's Attitude Around in 1 minute or less free with your order. 1-800-593-3750. 1-800-593-3750. It's guaranteed. So call now. 1-800-593-3750.
Just about 22 minutes after the hour here on the Paul Edwards program, the Bible says, "Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right." Rivka Berry, the 17-year-old runaway from Columbus, Ohio, who converted to Christianity from Islam, insists that she did so because she was fearful for her life. She feared an honor killing by her family once they discovered that she was converted to Christianity. However, her parents insist that they knew that she was exploring Christianity for the last year. They allowed her to do so. They knew that she was reading the Christian New Testament, and they knew that she had made this conversion to Christianity. And independent police reports indicate no threats were ever made to Rivka Berry, and certainly no harm had ever come to Rivka Berry. Now a federal court judge in Florida has remanded her to the temporary custody of these two pastors, ruling twice now against her parents, and now a Christian attorney who until September the 3rd was representing Rivka Berry's mother, says that Christians are on the wrong side of this, that that Christians, if Christians really believe the word of God, children obey your parents, that they ought to be supporting the right of these parents to raise Rivka, at least until she becomes an adult at the age of 18, the way they deem fit. Christians outraged when a federal judge forced a homeschooled girl to go into public school because he felt like the parents were not raising her properly. We said, now, wait a minute. Parents have the right to raise their kids the way they want. And yet evangelicals, when it comes to the Rivka Berry, the Rivka Berry case, seem to be saying the exact opposite. That Rivka's parents don't have the right to raise her the way they want. And I'm wondering if there's an evangelical double standard. 866-423-WLQV, 866-423-9578. Justin in Ortonville, welcome to the Paul Edwards program.
Thanks for taking my call, Paul.
You're welcome.
You know, I have a tendency to agree with both you and this attorney. We do kind of have the double standard in the church. The second we hear the name, second we hear Muslim, we seem to go against it at every turn we can, without really giving any real thought as to what we're siding with. So, you know, I think that you and this attorney are definitely right in kind of calling out this young woman to be obedient in Christ, because that really is what is going to make, I mean, if there's any hope of her making an impact on her parents to become Christian, I mean, that's the best way to do it, is by her submitting to her parents and showing them that she loves them no matter what their religious affiliation is. So
I think you hit something on the head there, Justin. Christians do seem to have a ready bias at hand whenever Islam is involved. Now, look, Islam has been responsible at least I'm not even going to go so far as to say those who adhere to it in an extreme kind of way. People who just read the Quran and take it seriously were responsible for, flying planes into our World Trade Center and in the Pentagon. And so Islam is a very dangerous religion, and we have to take that very, very seriously. But at the same time, I don't think that merely because Rivka's parents are Islamic, that they adhere to the Islamic faith, while we need to be concerned to a certain point, I don't think that we can just paint with a broad brush. And evangelicals seem to do that. Well, if you're an adherent to Islam, you must be going to kill your daughter if she converts to Christianity. And independent police agencies have said there's just no evidence for that. Now, on the other hand, you bring up another valid point. We certainly don't want to see any harm come to Rivka Berry. But Jesus made it clear, if you follow me, it comes with a cost. And Rivka Berry may indeed end up, I hope this isn't the case, but some radical extreme Muslim might indeed try to do her harm or succeed in doing her harm. But isn't that exactly what Jesus said would happen to us if we put our lives on the line? And I think that's something that evangelical Christians have also lost sight of.
Well, yeah, and I totally agree with you. I think that when it comes to anything, we've become evangelicals to a large extent, which I belong to. They have definitely forgotten what it means to be selfless. Mm. We've kind of turned into a very selfish, inward-turning kind of group that when it comes to having to give our own lives for the cause of the cross, that's not something we're willing to do for the most part. I think there are some of us that are because we understand what the cross is and what the call of the cross is and what Jesus called us to in discipleship. But I really don't believe that the majority of us are willing or ready to lay our lives on the line for our Lord. And, you know, that has something to say about evangelicals. So it's kind of one of those things where we need, you know, I'm going to school at Rochester College to become a pastor. That's something that I see as a need as a pastor of really bringing out into the church is getting people to recognize that kind of faith is what's necessary for us to make any kind of an impact on the world around us.
There's no question, Justin, we need a theology of suffering in the church today. In the last 30 years, most of my adult life in the evangelical world has been the evangelical church has pampered its people and bent over backwards to get people in the door. I passed a church. I was driving down Dixie Highway last week, and I laughed out loud. I passed a church that had a sign on its marquee that said, "Doubling our attendance in October, come help us." And I'm thinking, this is what the evangelical church has come to, is to simply put a sign out and says, just help us double our attendance. We don't care about the gospel. We don't care about sacrifice. We just want to be sure we pack enough people in the pews to double the attendance. And we have lost the whole idea that Jesus said, if any man will come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. And we've lost this whole notion of suffering.
Yeah, we definitely have. And it's like we've forgotten what Jesus said in Luke 9 when he talks about discipleship. You know, the foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. And yet we think that when we become Christian, suffering is something that goes out the window. And the reality of it is that when you become a Christian, you're going to suffer even more than likely, because you're being called to something that, in a lot of ways, is painful. You're being refined and changed and made something different than what you were before, which is a painful process.
Great call, Justin. I appreciate your thoughts very, very much. You know, Jesus also said the day is coming when a man's enemies will be those of his own household. And certainly Rivka Berry is an example of that. If her parents are enemies of the Christian faith and therefore an enemy of Rivka Berry, Rivka is merely fulfilling the prophecy of Jesus. And she needs to walk by faith and not by sight. I'm certainly not suggesting that Rivka needs to keep herself in a position where she could be harmed. But if she is harmed for the gospel's sake, if you be buffeted for righteousness' sake, happy are ye, is what the Word of God says. And we've lost that perspective in the evangelical church. 866 423-WLQV. Tony in Jackson, Michigan, listening on the internet. Welcome.
Hey, Paul, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
That's good. I'm on your side on just about 90% of everything you say, even though when people come against you, I love you. I wish you could come through in Jackson much clearer, but it's okay. I get to stream you on the web.
I'm glad you are.
Say, I'm on Ripka's side 150%. I know the Bible says children obey your parents in the Lord. I don't think your parents are in the Lord. And I know it says in Colossians, obey your parents. But the thing that gets me is what they say about the police report, where it says there is no physical evidence. Well, police took victims back to Jeffrey Dahmer. I mean, I want to try to sound as intelligent as all the other callers, but that's what they did. And he just kept chopping them up. So, I mean, I'm on her side, and I think she knows more about the situation than anyone on the outside.
And Tony,
listen, Paul.
Yeah, Tony, I think your position represents probably the majority of this audience. It was a very intelligent call, and I'm sure that a majority of people in this audience agree. And look, again, I want to make it clear, I'm not suggesting that a judge send Rivka Berry back to Columbus, Ohio, where she could potentially be harmed, or where she could be back under the control of her parents and sent back to Sri Lanka, where some harmful things could happen to her there. My issue is not so much this case on its own, but the whole notion of evangelical support for parental authority. Where do we draw the line on parental authority? Tony rightly points out that Ephesians 6:1 says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Does that verse, however, give to Rivka Berry, who is now a convert to Christianity, her parents still Islamic, does that verse give Rivka the right to disobey her parents, to not do what her parents say? Her parents insist that for the last year, they have permitted her to explore Christianity and to read the Christian New Testament and to explore her faith. That's what her parents say. Rivka doesn't deny that, by the way. There isn't any indication from Rivka that her parents have not permitted her to explore the Christian faith. So the issue is, you know, I'm not suggesting for a moment that Rivka ought to be sent back and put into harm's way and become a martyr for the Christian faith. Please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. For me, this becomes an issue of parental authority. When a federal judge ruled that Christian parents could not homeschool their daughter because they were teaching her too much Bible, she needed to go to the public school, evangelicals were outraged. Now when a federal judge rules that these Muslim parents don't have the right to raise their daughter the way they see fit, we're not outraged. Is there an evangelical double standard when it comes to parental authority? 866-423-WLQV, 866-423-9578. Rod in Warren, welcome, Rod.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Yeah, I just got a short little thing here. What do you think is meant by obeying in the Lord? I mean, how do we know that she didn't get a witness from the Holy Ghost that said leave? I mean, after all, we had an angel talk to Joseph and Mary, and they got Jesus away because he was going to be threatened.
Yeah, and I don't deny, Rod, that could supernaturally happen, but I think more than likely what she got was a series of emails from these pastors down in Florida encouraging her to leave.
How can you substantiate that?
Well, she was having email exchanges with these two pastors in Florida, and in those emails, she was warned that her parents may want to do an honor killing. The whole idea of honor killing was placed in Rivka's mind by these two pastors, husband and wife, who pastor this church, who said, "Now you realize, Rivka, that in Islam." And they named the Islamic term, which escapes me, your parents would be within their right to have you killed because you've denied the Islamic faith. That thought was placed in Rivka's mind by these two pastors. It wasn't her dad that came to her and said, you know, I'm going to kill you if you convert to the Christian faith. For a whole year, she was allowed in her own home to read the Christian New Testament, and her parents fully understood that.
Okay, so we're assuming that is a certainty that the parents did not do that, then.
It's a matter of court record. I mean,
right.
You know, nothing's for certain, Rod. Obviously, you know, you can have a he said, she said. Nothing is for certain. But this is how the court records read. And yet, even in light of these court records, you've got a federal judge who on two different occasions now has ruled that that it's unclear whether Rivka's life might be in danger. And so he's remanded her to the custody of these two pastors. So, you know, maybe he knows more than what the public records indicate. I certainly am not advocating, Rod, that Rivka be put in a situation where her life is in danger or she becomes a martyr for the Christian faith. I'm debating the principle. If we have a scripture that says children obey your parents in the Lord, now does that mean if you as a child are in the Lord, you obey your parents? Because you go further into 1 Peter and you've got Peter talking to the wives of unsaved husbands and telling them to submit to them. The unsaved husband certainly isn't in the Lord. The wife is. So it seems to me that what the scripture's teaching there is that the model of Christian obedience is for you to obey those who are in authority over you. If you are in the Lord, you're going to obey those who are in authority over you. That's the way I read the text. I don't think it means that those in authority over you have to be in the Lord.
That's your interpretation. I mean, to me, in the Lord, I think you got to be careful in the way you open that up and how you limit it or how far you open it up. To be in the Lord can mean, you know, that I'm walking in the Spirit, and so as the Spirit leads or prompts, then I follow. And, you know, sometimes the Spirit is so subtle that you can have that thought to get up and leave. And, I mean, you don't even have to hear an audible voice from God to, you know, to follow him. So, you know, I think it's, I don't know what else to say. I just, one other comment, though, is that you were kind of talking about how the church maybe doesn't stand up for Christ and take the, you know, some of the abuse of the world. I think you got to be careful how you say that, too, because how does that speak to the underground church throughout the world?
Well, yeah, and I specifically said, Rod, the American church. My brothers and sisters that I visited in Russia, in Senegal, I've seen these folks, and certainly there are Christians around the world who are suffering. If I didn't say it clearly enough, I certainly meant the American church has been pampered, and we're the ones that feel like nothing bad should ever happen to us.
Right. Right. And, I mean, in terms of the Islamic law, we know in the Old Testament that when children didn't obey their parents, that they could be stoned to death. And for any other violations of the law, there were a number of them where stoning to death was a requirement. So in terms of the Islamic side, if they have their freedom to for their religion, then, you know, they certainly have a just cause in their eyes, although we know that their God is not the true God.
Yeah, there's no question about that. Rod, thanks for the call. Appreciate it very much. 38 minutes after the hour, 866-423-WLQV. Help me send Bibles to my persecuted brothers and sisters in Southeast Asia. $80 will send 20 Bibles right now if we can get 20 listeners to do that. That's 400 Bibles this hour. And thanks to the dollar-for-dollar match, it's 800 Bibles. We're at 5,500 Bibles right now on our way to 10,000. Can we get to 6,000 today? 1-800-YES-WORD, 1-800-937-9673.
Has credit card debt ravaged your financial stability or your home life? Fresh Start America can help. In fact, they can eliminate up to 60% of your credit card debt. They negotiate with your creditors, reduce your debt, cut years off your payments, and stop the debt cycle. It's a proven solution. They're friendly, caring professionals who won't judge you or talk down to you. You will get your questions answered and your debt forgiven. Avoid bankruptcy. Cut your debt by thousands and enjoy life again. Imagine taking your credit card bills and cutting them in half. If you have over $10,000 in credit card debt, call for a free consultation. There's absolutely no cost or obligation. Call now, 800-207-9715. That's 800-207-9715. Don't wait. Call us at 800-207-9715. 800-207-9715.
This is Pastor David Washington asking you to join us on Transform Lives Ministry, airing every day, Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. You can also get more information about us at tlministries.net, tlministries.net. And this radio broadcast is going to be where the Word of God will absolutely change and transform your life.
Join Pastor David Washington Jr. for Transform Lives, weekdays at 11 a.m. here on AM 1500 WLQV.com. He said he would, he
said he would. Today, we're talking with the Internet.
Call me Web.
Okay. The hard question, are you really evil?
Yeah, you know. Do 100 good things, the press looks for one scandal.
What are you most proud of?
I'd say crosswalk.com.
Oh, a fabulous Christian destination.
Best in Christian living articles, resources, news, culture, entertainment, marriage, parenting.
Oh, and great free Bible study tools.
Yeah, daily devotions, a vibrant community of believers. Crosswalk.com is the intersection of faith and life.
Web, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
This is Scott Thunder of Bible League International with an urgent update on our Fill Their Empty Hands campaign to send Bibles to Southeast Asia. Tropical storm Kitana has wreaked a path of devastation through the Philippines, and the city of Manila was particularly hard hit. I spoke with Pastor Leo of the Bible League office in Manila, who shared the extent of the loss in Bibles and its consequences.
But the estimate is about more than 70,000 Bibles. We have nothing to give to the people who will be coming to the office. And we cannot send Bibles and materials to the provinces.
Thankfully, none of the Bible League Philippines staff suffered injury or death in this disaster. But with over 70,000 scriptures destroyed, we need your help more than ever to replace the loss. If you haven't called 1-800-YES-WORD yet to help fill their empty hands, would you call today? Call 1-800-937-9673 and mention Southeast Asia when you call with your gift. See pictures of the damage and get updates at myradiotrip.com.
42 minutes after the hour, the Paul Edwards Program, 866-423-WLQV. The President of the United States, along with the First Lady and Oprah Winfrey, are in Copenhagen. They may be on their way home by now, but they're there lobbying on behalf of the city of Chicago to get the Olympics in Chicago in 2016. Obama will probably still be president in 2016. My guess is that if he's reelected in 2012, I should say, he would still be president in 2016 when the Olympics take place in the summer of 2016, because then the election would be that year, right? November of 2016 would be the presidential election. It wouldn't surprise me a bit, just as an aside here, that the President of the United States, which amendment to the Constitution limited the terms of the president? The 22nd Amendment or the 25th Amendment? Right after John F. Kennedy, was assassinated, either the 22nd or 25th Amendment limits the term of the president to two. And it would not surprise me a bit if Barack Obama in 2016 or prior, you're nodding your head, 22 or 25?
That'd be 22.
The 22nd Amendment. Yes, my history. It's actually not history. That would be civics.
It'd be civical history.
Yes, my civical history is helping me out here. The 22nd Amendment. I don't want to say prophesy, because too many of you in the audience are looking for an opportunity to take me out to the city square and stone me if the prophecy fails. But I will venture an educated guess that there will be a move in this country. If Barack Obama is elected to a second term in 2012, that there will be an immediate move to rescind the 22nd Amendment, at least the provision on the term limits of the President of the United States. Mark my words. 866-423-WLQV, 866-423-9578. 78 here in the Center for the Study of God and Culture, the Paul Edwards Program. But here's my question. Is Barack Obama the mayor of Chicago or the president of the United States? Does the president of the United States have any business being in Copenhagen or anywhere else where the IOC is meeting, the International Olympic Committee, in order to lobby on behalf of a city? Just so happens to be the corrupt city, the city that Barack Obama is from. I was thinking, a couple of weeks ago when I was in Chicago for the U2 conference, the U2 concert, I was thinking, what a beautiful city. This must be what Jesus had in mind when he was talking about whited sepulchers, because it's so beautiful on the outside, but on the inside, it is so corrupt. I mean, it has got to be one of the most corrupt cities in the United States of America, and yet so beautiful on the outside. Michelle Obama today, in her address to the International Olympic Committee in Copenhagen, said it's such a sacrifice for her and Oprah to be there, but she's doing it for the kids. Those were her exact words. It's a sacrifice. Well, how many exactly how many millions of dollars did it cost the American taxpayer, number one, to fly her over there separately from the president, and then to fly the president over there to lobby on behalf of the city of Chicago for the Olympics? Then you add to the fact that most people in Chicago don't want the Olympics there. And then a national poll has just been released that indicates that 43%, a Rasmussen poll released today, that 43% of Americans think that President Obama's trip to Copenhagen to lobby the IOC was a bad idea. 36% of respondents says it was a good idea. 21% weren't sure. Nearly half, 49%, said they are following the president's trip at least somewhat closely. The same margin, 48%, said it was at least somewhat important that the games come to the president's hometown of Chicago. Then you start looking at the people who stand to benefit from the Olympic Games coming to Chicago. Valerie Jarrett, who is a special advisor to the president, soon, no doubt, if the Olympics do end up coming to Chicago, soon, no doubt, to be named the Olympic Czar. She's got contracts with companies in Chicago that stand to have millions of dollars in cash flowing their direction if the Olympics come their way. There's also another White House senior advisor, David Axelrod, who is involved in real estate interests in Chicago. And of course, when Olympics come to a city, you got to start tearing things down and building things up. And people who own property in the area where those venues need to be built stand to make a great deal of money. Has there been a president in recent memory? I'm not suggesting there's never been a president that does what I'm about to say, but has there been a president in recent memory that has so flagrantly utilized his authority and position as president to pay off his political friends? This seems to be exactly what is afoot here. This is not some patriotic trip to Copenhagen to try to get the Olympics in the United States of America. This is about the city of Chicago. You do not hear Michelle Obama or Oprah Winfrey talking about America. You hear them talking about Chicago. And of course, this is the president's adopted hometown. Of course, we know he was born in Indonesia. Actually, Hawaii. Indonesia, closer to the fact, but he was born in Hawaii. At least that's what the rigged birth certificate seems to suggest. Am I starting to sound like a birther?
You're a birther truther.
I'm a birther truther. So Chicago is the adopted hometown of President Obama. Do you think the president of the United States ought to be spending his time in Copenhagen when we are when we're dealing with nuclear Iran right now? The other thing is, as a part of this trip, he's supposed to make a stop in a neutral location where, for the first time, an American president will sit down face-to-face with Iran. He's already lifted most of the embargo against Cuba, travel embargoes with people in Cuba. He's obviously a good friend of Hugo Chavez. They like to exchange books when they see one another. This president leaves a bad taste in one's mouth. 866-423-WLQV, 866-423-9578. When we continue here on the Paul Edwards program, I'm going to tell you where he's really leaving a bad taste in my mouth, and that's with his Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools, this Kevin Jennings guy, who was named the director of the Department of Education's Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools. He's also the founder of the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network. He is openly gay. He was appointed to this position a few months ago, and there was a large cry from the evangelical world when that happened. I'm going to tell you why we ought to continue screaming. Jake Tapper from ABC News filed a report yesterday that is quite disturbing. And I'm going to tell you why we need to put some pressure on the White House to get Kevin Jennings out of there. 866-423-WLQV.
Is credit card debt making your life miserable? Are you tired of harassing phone calls and struggling to make ends meet? You may qualify for a little-known program through Debt Consultants of America. This program allows you to pay back a small portion of the credit card debt you owe. In fact, up to 60% of your credit card debt can be completely wiped clean. It's a proven program. The best part, Debt Consultants of America does all the work for you. Plus, you don't have to pay back a penny of the debt they settle for you. So grab all of your credit cards and statements and call for a free, no-obligation consultation. Their friendly counselors will give you all the details. Call 800-718-0258. That's 800-718-0258. Call now, 800-718-0258. You do need to have $10,000 in credit card debt to qualify for this program. For a free, no-obligation consultation, please call 800-718-0258, 800-718-0258.
Has your computer been slowing down? Are you having problems with your email? Or when you go to the internet, is your browser taking so long to load that it seems like the worldwide wait? I'm Luke Ford, CEO of My Computer Works. We help people just like you with computer problems you can't fix. With one easy call, we can help you get your computer working the way you want it, speeding it back up, making sure you can send and receive emails, and making the internet fun again. You'll speak to a U.S.-based technician who knows what they're doing, who can usually fix your computer on the very first call. If your computer's been slowing down, you can't get your email to work, your internet's taking forever, or if you're not sure what's wrong, but your computer's just not working the way you want it, call My Computer Works, and we'll help you fast.
The number to call is 800-466-1849. That's 800-466-1849. Toll free, 800-466-1849.
My Computer Works. Does yours?
800-466-1849.
The Chesapeake Life Insurance Company, Midwest National Life Insurance Company of Tennessee, and the Mega Life and Health Insurance Company bring you this message. Life can be full of risks. One thing you shouldn't take a risk with is your family's health insurance. If you're self-employed or an individual and you need health insurance, you need to make this free call right now and see how the Health Markets companies can help you get it. We specialize in helping the self-employed and individuals just like you who need flexible health insurance. For quality family health insurance, give us a call right now. 866-371-4655. 866-371-4655. 866-371-4655. North Richland Hills, Texas. Exclusions and limitations apply. Market and plans vary by state. Not licensed in all states. Association group plans, where available, require association membership.
If you don't know who Kevin Jennings is, you need to get to know him. He is the founder of GLSEN, the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network. These are the kind of extreme homosexual rights lobbying groups that sponsor things like the Day of Silence, encouraging kids to let their voices not be heard in support of homosexuality. Here is Kevin Jennings in his own words talking about why he founded GLSEN.
From that moment forward, an unusual journey began for me, which has led to the creation of the organization known as GLSEN, the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network, which works to make school a place where young children learn to value and respect everyone, regardless of their sexual orientation or their gender identity. I wish I could report to you terribly good news, and in some ways there are incredibly good news. A few weeks after that conversation with that boy, a young girl came into my office and said she wanted to start a club to fight homophobia at our school. And I was kind of surprised because I knew her mainly as the hot freshman girl with the hot senior boyfriend who were making out outside my office every day. So I hadn't anticipated that she was a lesbian. So I said to her, I said, tell me why you feel so passionately about this, expecting she would then come out to me. And she said, oh, because my mother's a lesbian and I'm tired of hearing my family get put down around here.
That's Kevin Jennings talking about why he founded GLSEN. The young boy that he counseled in his office, he was a high school teacher at the time. The young boy's name is Brewster. Brewster squirmed at the prospect. I'm reading from Kevin Jennings' own book, One Teacher in Ten. published in 1994. Brewster, the student, squirmed at the prospect of telling, and we sat silently for a short while. On a hunch, I suddenly asked, "What's his name?" Now, listen, Brewster is a 14, 15-year-old kid. Brewster's eyes widened briefly and then outspilled a story about his involvement with an older man he had met in Boston. I listened, sympathized, and offered advice. He left my office with a smile on his face that I would see every time I saw him on the campus for the next 2 years until he graduated. Jennings told a GLSEN conference that Brewster told him he met someone in the bus station bathroom and I went home with him. High school sophomore, 15 years old, that was the only way he knew how to meet gay people. I was a closeted gay teacher, Jennings says, 24 years old, didn't know what to say, knew I should say something quickly. So I finally, my best friend had just died of AIDS the week before. I looked at Brewster and said, "You know, I hope you knew to use a condom." And he said to me something I will never forget. He said, "Why should I? My life isn't worth saving anyway." This is a high school teacher who heard a 15-year-old sophomore in his school say, "I was picked up by an adult male in a bathroom and had a sexual encounter with him. Now I think I'm in love with him." Every federal law, every state law says that Jennings was required to report that. That is sex with a minor. And the White House today is just giving a wink and a nod to this whole thing. This is the guy that's running the Office of Safe Schools? If you've got a student in the public schools, do you feel safe knowing that a former school teacher who had a student report to him that he was picked up for a homosexual liaison by an adult male, and the teacher condoned it and congratulated him and said how wonderful it is you found a loving relationship? You know why this kid says my life isn't worth saving anyway? Because of those kind of relationships. Homosexuality is God's condemnation on rejecting his glory, Romans chapter 1. This kid doesn't need to be encouraged to continue in these kind of homosexual liaisons. This kid needs to be encouraged to get some help. And yet we've got a psychotic sex addict running the Office of Safe Schools. This is the man you voted in as president of the United States that hangs out with creeps like Van Jones and Kevin Jennings and puts him in charge of things that have a direct impact on your family. What are you doing? Are you not paying attention to what's going on? Are you just thinking that the government runs on autopilot and everything's gonna be fine? We have a president that condones this kind of stuff. We have a president that is responsible for more legislation ending the lives of unborn children than any president we've ever had. Now we potentially have a president who is responsible for spreading the homosexual agenda in our public schools via his friend Kevin Jennings, and you call yourself an evangelical Christian and you voted for Barack because Barack was going to make sure that you didn't have to pay your mortgage and Barack was going to make sure you had gas in your car. What Barack is doing is killing the morality of our nation by appointments like Kevin Jennings to the Office of Safe and Drug-Free Schools. Oh, by the way, later in this same book, Kevin Jennings rages about the wonderful time he had using drugs as a teacher in high school. More of the Paul Edwards program right after SRN News here on AM 1500.
Individual results may vary. Program not available in all states. See contract for complete terms.
If your credit card debt is out of control, if you're in over your head dealing with monthly payments, there's powerful information you need to know about the government's bailout of credit card companies. If you have more than $10,000 in credit card debt, you have the right to settle that debt for a fraction of what you owe. With monthly payments you can afford, credit card companies have been given billions and need to clean their books once and for all. And that's great news for you. We're Credit Answers, and we'd like to offer you free information that will show you how to settle your credit card debt with payment plans customized for you. It's yours free by calling 1-800-410-2703. Don't declare bankruptcy. Give us 10 minutes and learn how we have saved our clients millions. Live better, debt-free. For free information on how to settle your credit card debt in a government bailout era, call 1-800-410-2703. That's 1-800-410-2703. 1-800-410-2703.
Pastor Jerry here of Tough Questions Bible Answers. You know, we've all got them. We've all got those parts of the Bible we avoid or subjects we skim past, not wanting to admit we're kind of clueless about what they really mean. Questions about faith, why bad things happen to good people, salvation, sin, sovereignty, forgiveness, finances. You get the picture. I don't pretend to have all the answers, but I've discovered a thing or two in my 2.5 decades pastoring. So tune in Monday through Friday, 6 to 7 p.m. right here on AM 1500 WLQV, life-changing talk radio.
It's a new day in Christian talk. This is life-changing talk radio, AM 1500, WLQV, Detroit.
A service of Salem Communications.
With SRN News, I'm Keith Peters in Washington. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says the talks with Iran today in Switzerland over their nuclear program were productive, but it's just a start.
We want to see concrete actions and positive results, and I think... Today's meeting opened the door, but let's see what happens.
But SRN News military analyst, retired Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, says he doesn't see anything substantive coming out of today's talks.
At the end of the day, what we'll find is either capitulation by the West and or resignation that they're going to become an atomic weapons capable nation, or, you know, just kick the can down the road.
Javier Solana, the EU's top foreign policy official, also confirmed Iran and six world powers will hold a new set of talks on international concerns about Tehran's nuclear program. Also at SRNNews.com, pro-lifers in the House of Representatives are demanding a full House vote on abortion. SRN's Doug Sacklaven reports.
183 House members, including 25 Democrats, have signed a letter urging the Speaker of the House to allow a floor vote on a pro-life amendment to health care reform. Some Democrats, including the president, have said the legislation does not change existing prohibitions on federal funding of abortion, but the letter asserts that the bill, quote, radically departs from current federal policy. If a vote on the amendment is not allowed, up to 40 Democrats may join Republicans in a procedural move that could block health care legislation from getting to the House floor. Doug Sacklaven, Capitol Hill.
Federal officials want new strict laws against distracted driving. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says the first step is a push to ban text messaging by interstate bus drivers and truckers.
We are not going to break every one of their bad habits, but we are going to raise awareness and sharpen the consequences.
A bad day on Wall Street with the Dow down by 203 points. This is SRN News.
Coming up here in just a few moments on the Paul Edwards program, we're going to revisit a conversation, actually a part two of the conversation with Jim Belcher on his book, Deep Church, A Third Way Beyond Emerging and Traditional. We talked to Pastor Belcher about a week or so ago, and the conversation went so well, I said, let's have you back to pick it up where we left off. The whole debate between the emerging and traditional churches. What is it that the emerging church is protesting? What is it about the traditional church that the emerging church doesn't like? And why is it that people like John MacArthur are saying, as he is right now in his morning series at 8 a.m. here on AM 1500, that we ought not be you can't have a conversation with heretics. Heretics are to be condemned. That is the gist of what John MacArthur is saying about the emerging church. And this new book, Deep Church, A Third Way Beyond Emerging and Traditional, is neither in favor 100% of the traditional church or in favor of the emerging church. And Tim Keller endorses the book, and I've got great deal of respect for Tim Keller. Mark Driscoll's on here endorsing the book, along with guys like Rob Bell, who's a guy I necessarily wouldn't endorse, quite frankly, quite honestly. But this is an important book. That is going to make a big difference in the conversation that we have about the emerging church and the traditional church. And you can visit the website to learn more about it, www.thedeepchurch.com. Let me remind you, please, that we are tomorrow's the deadline, October 2nd, 10,000 Bibles is where we want to be. We are not quite to 6,000 Bibles yet. $80 will send 20 Bibles, 1-800-YES-WORD, 1-800-937-9673 is the number to call to send Bibles. $4 sends one. An $80 gift right now will send 20, but thankfully there's a dollar-for-dollar match in place. Your $80 gift today and tomorrow's the deadline, will send 40 Bibles. If we can get 20 listeners this hour to make a one-time gift of just $80, that's 400 Bibles on the way to Southeast Asia. And of course, Monday I reported to you the disaster that struck there in Southeast Asia. 90,000 Bibles destroyed in our warehouse in Manila. Those Bibles need to be replaced. If you ever needed a reason to give, now is the time to do so. 1-800-YES-WORD, 1-800-937-9673. It's just $4 to send one Bible, and that's all I'm asking you to do. I want 20 of you to make an $80 gift. But the majority of you, I just need a $4 gift. And again, I know what you're saying. Paul, I would be embarrassed to give the minimum amount. I don't know why. $4, if 100 listeners gave $4, that's 400 Bibles. Don't be embarrassed about the amount. It's not what you give, it's that you give. 1-800-YES-WORD, 1-800-937-9673. Let's get 400 more Bibles this hour. Let's get to the 6,000 mark. On our way to 10,000 Bibles by this time tomorrow, 1-800-YES-WORD, 1-800-937-9673.
No one likes to hear that sound, but because cold weather is coming, so will new demands on your vehicle. The change in weather will test your battery and your alternator charging system with those cold weather starts. If your car is a 2005 or older, you're at the life expectancy for the battery. It would be wise to have it tested before winter hits. Another concern is to check or replace the antifreeze with a thorough radiator heater core coolant flush. We will also check the radiator and heater hoses, plus the belts and tires. Be ready for winter this year and let Master Auto help. 313-532-2500. Master Auto is located on 7 Mile and Inkster in Redford. Don't forget that modern vehicles need tune-ups once they hit 80,000 miles or the five-year mark. Bob, Greg, or Tina will be happy to politely assist you with your automotive needs. Master Auto. Price, quality, service. 313-532-2500.
Are credit card bills stressing you out? Do you find yourself living paycheck to paycheck, hanging your head in embarrassment with $4,000 or more in unsecured debt? Call Consumer Education Services Incorporated, a nonprofit organization, for help. They'll give you a free consultation and a clear picture of how to permanently get out of debt. Here's the number.
800-948-6814, 800-948-6814, 800-948-6814.
The Equip for Life team asked our audience why they listen to Equip for Life with Pastor Christopher Brooks.
Hello, my name is Jeremy. I'm from Detroit, Michigan. I'm a father. I'm also a public school teacher. What Equip for Life has done for me is really helped me to see that it's so important to have a one-on-one relationship with Jesus Christ. It was definitely evident that Pastor Brooks was in love with Jesus Christ and that he wanted you to feel that love also.
Equip for Life with Pastor Christopher Brooks can be heard Monday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on AM 1500 WLQV.
Just about 8 minutes after the hour here on the Paul Edwards program, 866-423-WLQV. You can also send us an instant message in studio at the website at godandculture.com. About a week and a half ago, it was our pleasure to have Jim Belcher on the program for the first time to talk about his new book, Deep Church, A Third Way Beyond Emerging and Traditional. Jim is a founding church planner and lead pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in Newport Beach, California, and you can visit the website for this book, www.thedeepchurch.com. Jim, it's great to welcome you back here to Detroit in the Paul Edwards program.
Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me back.
You know, when last we talked, it almost sounds like a Lone Ranger radio serial, but when last we talked, we were talking about the fact that evangelicals have always been a people of protest. I mean, you go back to the Reformation, it's about protest, and I think I think one of the, you know, and I would consider myself a traditional evangelical, to use your demarcations here between traditional and emerging. I'm hoping once we have several more conversations, I might go this third way deep church, because that's appealing to me. But I would consider myself traditional. And from that vantage point, I look down at my emerging friends, and I do consider many of them friends, and I say, what are you protesting? What are our friends on the emerging side protesting?
Great question. Yeah, no question they're protesting, although it's they're probably not as loudly as they were even five or six years ago. But what I did is, as I got into the literature, I realized that there were some common themes in what they were protesting towards the traditional church. And I go over seven of them in a chapter, and then I take each one of them over the course of subsequent chapters and devote a whole chapter to each one. And let me, if I can, I will list them off. But the first one starts with a protest that the traditional church is too wedded to the Enlightenment. And so they feel like we've sold out to kind of Enlightenment rationalism or reason. The second is a too narrow view of salvation. The third critique is the belief before belonging idea. They want to reverse that. Fourth would be uncontextualized worship. I mean, they just think that most of the worship and the style is stuck in the 16th, 17th century. Fifth, ineffective preaching. Sixth, weak ecclesiology. And seven, they accuse the traditional church of being tribalistic, too separate from culture and not caring enough of those in the post-Christian environment. And so that's those each, you know, and then each one in the emerging camp, and I go on and talk about how the emerging camp is a broad movement with different subgroups, and each one of those has a little different take on each of these seven, but more or less, these are the seven critiques that you're going to find in a lot of the emerging literature.
Yeah, and I like the way you start with truth. I don't know if that's intentional or not, but I mean, good grief, if you lose the foundations, and I guess foundationalism, in the strictest sense, the academic sense of foundationalism, is something that the emerging church or many in the emerging camp would find themselves pushing against, this notion that there is such a thing as definitive truth. And you rightly point out that they say, you know, the traditional church seems to run to the Enlightenment, to rationalism, to reason, and everything's got to be one, two, three. You know, MacArthur, you know, is sure to give you three or four points, and it's easily followed. And I get all of that, but I mean, truth, Jesus said, sanctify them through thy truth. Thy word is truth. And so how does the emerging church deal with the fact of truth outside of an Enlightenment context?
Yeah, good question. Your first point was interesting. Is there a reason why it was put first? And yes, because it is so foundational, but also because in the early days, and I'm thinking 10 years ago or so, the emerging church really stressed this postmodern conversation. Not so much now, but in the early days, they were really, really pushing on this and making the case for postmodernism. And what I do in the chapter is I start with this story that I have probably 10 years ago when I was at a church plant conference here in Orange County, California. One of the young church planters was talking about planting a postmodern church. And I kind of scratched my head and I thought, really? To me, postmodernism was not a positive term. And so they kept using it. So I went on a little bit of a search to find out whether it was possible that the emerging and the traditional people were using it differently. Well, how did they define postmodernism? Because when I was going through my doctoral studies in the 90s, postmodernism was almost always a negative term. It wasn't a good thing. But these young emerging pastors were using it as a positive thing. And what I realized is that they saw postmodernism as a healthy critique of the Enlightenment. It was the thing that came in and kicked the legs or the scaffolding out from under the Enlightenment project, which was reason without revelation, which was always was never an ally really of the church. Actually forced us out of the spiritual realm and out of the public realm. So they saw this as a good thing. The traditional church just saw it as an extension of the Enlightenment reason, where it became relativism. It became self-centeredness. It became whatever you wanted in life, you got. So they saw it as a negative thing. So as I began to dig, I realized that both sides were really missing each other on this. There are some good things about postmodernism. It does a really good job of dismantling the Enlightenment. But the problem is that, you know, where it's really strong on the negative critique, it doesn't provide the positive moving forward. It doesn't help us figure out what justice or truth is, and we're just left in kind of a neutral position. Where the emerging church often will get into trouble, and they don't all do this, but some do, when they look to postmodernism to actually generate truth or to generate the way forward when it comes to justice, I think they get into trouble there, because postmodernism is mainly negative. It doesn't have a positive agenda. For the positive agenda, you really got to look to Revelation. You've got to be able to say, what's our authority? How is God spoken into our reality and into our world? And that's where we move forward. And that's what we call truth. The reason that emerging guys and gals don't like the word truth is because it's often linked to the Enlightenment. But if we understand that truth isn't based on reason, truth is based on our belief, then we're okay.
You know, when I talked to Spencer Burke here on this program, he's one of the first guests I had on about 4 years ago when I first started broadcasting here. And I've talked to Spencer Burke, I've talked to Tony Jones, Brian McLaren. You know, I've said to every one of these guys, it seems to me that what the emergents are doing is simply trading one culture for another. While they have this reaction against modernism, they seem to be, and I may be wrong about this, and you've done the research, maybe you can help me, but on the surface of things, Jim, it seems like that the emerging church is in love with postmodernism in the same way that maybe the traditional church had been in love with modernism, and aren't they therefore in danger of making the same mistake?
They very well could be if they look at postmodernism more than the negative critique. If you say I love postmodernism because it really disqualifies the Enlightenment, then I say yes, it's great. It really does a good job of that in the philosophical realm. But if you're saying we're going to look to postmodernism to now help us steer our way clear and move forward in areas of justice and in truth and in how we organize our culture and our society, I would say there's no resources there for it. Or if there are, they're not the kind of resources we want. And in my book, I call this jumping on the postmodern bandwagon too quickly. They just simply don't, because postmodernism is open to the transcendent, but it doesn't provide the transcendent. It cannot give us the solid resources that we need in order to develop holistic selves, you know, personalities, justice in the world, purpose and meaning. If you're going to get those things, you've got to go to Revelation. And I think you're right. If they're looking to postmodernism, which I don't think that many of them are anymore, I think they would be in trouble. But when I look at a lot of them, they really are going back to the scriptures. They are really mining the resources of the Christian tradition for those things. In the early days, I think they might have pushed for it, for postmodernism. But I think now they're realizing that the postmodern project has kind of been useful, and now it's time to move on and find our ideas of justice in a different place.
Jim Belcher is my guest, founding church planter and lead pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian Church in Newport Beach, California. His book, Deep Church, A Third Way Beyond Emerging and Traditional. His website, www.thedeepchurch.com. So how does what we've just been talking about, the postmodern influence on the emerging church, and maybe now many of them drifting away from that, but nonetheless, in terms of how emergents view contextualizing the gospel versus the traditional evangelical view of come out from among them and be ye separate, how does the view of the emergents, their sympathy towards postmodernism, for lack of a better phrase, affect the way they do ministry and do worship and do preaching?
Great question. You know, where the emerging side of the equation is going to get into trouble if they do is if they put, and this would be a kind of a postmodern thing, if they put too much stress on the community as the vehicle for finding truth and justice. In other words, the traditional side, or even the third way side that I posit, would say the community, is, as it takes the scriptures into its hands and into its community, it obviously has to interpret it for its own time. But when we look at community does that, it doesn't just do it with the scriptures, but it brings in the great tradition and all the wisdom of church history to help us understand what we're doing. There is a danger on the emerging side, not all of them, but particularly on the emergent side, there's a little bit of a danger, I think, when they, if they put community above or on an equal value with the scriptures. In other words, if the scriptures are not somehow valued as having the primary place as God's revelation speaking into our world, there's a danger that we put our community there. And if community then becomes just as important or an equal voice, the danger is you got to say to yourself, well, what happens if the community just begins to mimic the culture that's around us? Mm. What's going to hold that accountable? What's the plumb line? What's the thing? Do you understand what I'm saying? And so when the danger is for anybody in the postmodern world is we say, well, we're going to figure out truth on our own in our community,
yep,
without always saying no. Community is always looking to the higher authority. And so that's the fear. And the traditional pushback is, gosh, you guys, if that's the case, then you're going to get so close to the culture that eventually you won't be able to distinguish what you're supposed to be as a community in Christ with what's going on in the world.
You know, when Spencer Burke was on this program 4 years ago, you know, his book, A Heretic's Guide to Eternity, we were broadcasting downtown Detroit at that time, and we have a park here, a city park called Campus Martius. I told him after I read his book that, very tongue-in-cheek, and thankfully he laughed when I said it. I said, we're going to, you know, tie you to a stake and do what they did in the 16th century to heretics, and he got the point. But one of the things that I said to Spencer and I've said to others is, as I read these works from emergence, and, you know, it's not all of it's bad, but you bring up community, Jim, and it seems to me that what they say, their view of authority is not Scripture, that Scripture is not the final authority, that whatever the consensus of the community says Scripture says is the final authority, and that seems quite dangerous to me.
Well, yeah, I think it is. And again, just to be clear for your readers, and I bring this out in the book, that the emerging camp is very broad, and what we're talking about is one segment of the emerging camp. Now, there'd be people in the emerging camp who would agree with kind of our analysis here. And then there would be people in the emergent, somewhat on the emergent side, who would disagree with others in the emerging camp how they see these issues. So there's a lot of different play on this. But I think you're right, and I think whenever you privilege the community and put it that high in its understanding or how it comes to truth, I think it's very dangerous because there's really nothing to check the community. And there's nothing to keep the community from running into the arms of the world, and I mean the worldview of the world, not necessarily that we care about loving and taking care of and valuing creation, but you know what I mean. There's nothing there that then holds the community accountable. And for the last 2,000 years, the thing that's done that in the Christian community is the scriptures, and the scriptures as it's interpreted by the great tradition. And that's what keeps us from becoming, the fancy word is syncretistic, yep, where we don't begin to just blend, our views blend right into the world's views.
Jim Belcher, my guest. When we continue after the break, Jim, I want to explore some of the alternative that you're offering, Deep Church, and what you mean by that. Jim's book, Deep Church, A Third Way Beyond Emerging and Traditional. The website, www.thedeepchurch.com. The Paul Edwards Program continues with Jim Belcher.
Hi, I'm Lisa, and Andy Willoughby's three-step plan has allowed me to be home with my children. I see the three-step plan being able to provide enough income for so many families that they're going to be able to keep their home, keep their second car, just being able to provide shoes and whatever else their children need. We've been waiting for 10 years to put a deck on the back of our house, and we're going to be getting that deck now. Andy Willoughby's three-step plan plan can make a change in your life. You can actually look out your window and be able to dream again. Not only am I going to be home with my children, but our future sees my husband being home as a full-time dad, too.
Hi, how in the world are you anyway? I'm Andy Willoughby. For more information, go to 3stepplan.com or call 800-305-5482. 800-305-5482.
What makes the miracles of Jesus even more miraculous? Standing where they happened, in Israel. Come visit Capernaum, where Jesus restored a paralytic's helpless legs. Sail the Sea of Galilee, where Jesus walked on the water to meet his disciples. Stroll through Cana, where Jesus transformed water into wine. Walk in the footsteps of Jesus. See the Bible come alive before your eyes. Sense God's presence like never before. To learn more about Standing Where It All Happened in Israel, visit www.goisrael.com. That's www.goisrael.com. Come visit Israel. You'll never be the same.
You'll never be the same.
Start your morning with meaning on AM 1500 WLQV. As the leader in Christian talk in southeastern Michigan, WLQV features the best in Christian teachers, starting at 7 a.m. with the Briscoes, then Dennis Rainey, John MacArthur at 8, R.C. Sproul, and Alistair Begg. Together, it's decades of teaching the life-changing gospel of Jesus Christ with passion and excellence. Listen and learn, and then let revival begin. AM 1500 WLQV.
This is Pastor Jerry of Tough Questions Bible Answers. There are two important reasons I make an investment of my time to do this show. First of all, the average believer can't give an adequate defense for what they believe. Number two, so many Christians reevaluate their theology in light of their experience. Paul told Timothy, study to show yourself approved unto God. Let's look into some tough questions Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. and discover Bible answers right here at AM 1500 WLQV, life-changing talk radio.
You know, on the traditional side of things, there probably are two very vocal voices that are pushing against the emerging church. One would be, of course, Dr. John MacArthur. The other would be D.A. Carson. MacArthur, more from a pastoral perspective. Carson, from a more academic. Not that MacArthur's not being theological, but MacArthur, Jim, just started. We're talking with Jim Belcher here. Deep Church: A Third Way Beyond Emerging and Traditional. On the Paul Edwards program, MacArthur just started a series on his radio program this week, Confronting Error with Condemnation, Not Conversation. And, of course, the emergents like to invite us all to the table for conversation. They talk about the emerging conversation. What do you make of guys like MacArthur that are so vocal? You know, he would say these guys need to be condemned. They're heretics.
Yeah, one of the dangers is when you lump everybody into the same camp, and that's one of the things that worries me is some of the early critiques focused on one or two guys on the emerging side, and threw the whole conversation into the dumpster, you know, based on one or two. And I think even whether it's Doug Padgett or Tony Jones or Brian McLaren, I think they would say that they don't speak for the entire emerging conversation. They may speak for a smaller group or a different conversation. And I think what happens with both John MacArthur and Carson is I think they often lump all of them together. And I wanted to make really sure that when I laid out this case that I was really being fair to the other side. I was describing the emerging conversation in ways that they would recognize. I think that's really important. I'm not saying whether MacArthur or Carson don't at this point. I haven't listened to John's new series that he's doing. But I would just want to make sure that we're really accurate. So what I did in the book is whenever I was looking at one of the seven protests, is I took a different emerging thinker, and I really did a deep dive on their thinking so if they read that chapter, they would say, you know what, I recognize my thinking in here. okay, I agree with that. And then if I were to disagree with them, that I could show why. So I don't think we ever get past the need in the Christian community or even with those we disagree with being civil and conversing in a way that is loving towards the people where we may disagree with.
I totally concur with that. Now, the question becomes, what is the third way? We talked last time about deep church coming from the mind of C.S. Lewis, but you know, most people in this audience, Jim, are going to understand what a traditional church looks like. Probably half might understand a little bit about what the emerging church or an emergent congregation might look like. Mm-hmm. But what does a deep church look like?
It's a great question, and I don't necessarily. I use my church as an example, but I don't necessarily hold it up as the perfect example. I think we are still in the process of making the ideal reality as well. And so, what I do in each chapter is I lay out the seven different protests, and then I let the traditional church push back. Is then I present a third way that I think builds off of maybe the strengths of each side, but probably in most cases presents a position that either side probably hasn't looked at or hasn't seen, so that we can move beyond the conflict to real dialogue and hopefully real unity and mission. So if you take an example like belief before belonging, the emerging church wants to say the problem with the traditional church is you put belief before someone can even belong. So they've got to have all their theological T's crossed and I's dotted, and they've got to have their life cleaned up, and they got to look like us, they got to dress like us, they got to talk like us, believe like us, before they're going to feel comfortable. And I tell a story of an example of a traditional church where one guy was sharing his frustration with me that his small church had only had 3 visitors in the last 6 months that had signed the guest book. And I said, well, what happened when they came? And he said, when I was watching the people in our church greet them, I could tell by the looks on their face that they were going up and subtly quizzing them and trying to figure out if they were one of us before they would really be friendly to them. Now, I don't think they do that overtly, but I think a lot of churches, we give litmus tests when guests come in. Are they going to fit in?
Yep.
And so that's belief before belonging. Well, the emerging church pushes back and says, no, people are converted by first belonging. We need to let them come into the community and feel the love and the freedom in our community to ask questions. And I affirm that on some levels, but what I do is I say there's really a third way. Not only do we do want to be welcoming, but at some point when they're in our midst, we're going to call them to conversion. We're going to call them the way Jesus did when he was on his way to Jerusalem, and he finally asked his followers, "Do you believe in me? Do you know who I am?" And the church eventually calls people deeper to the well at the center, which is Christ, into more belief. But the person who comes into the church is free to come, to ask questions. They're welcome. They're loved. We don't, but we're going to look for ways to entice them through the love of Christ deeper in and hopefully to a commitment. That's what a deep church is. And I call that also a centered set church, where we don't put the boundaries on the outside. We put the well in the middle. We sink the well where the water is deep down and people are drawn to it.
Certainly, we need to be welcoming of unbelievers. I think Paul advocates that in his Corinthian epistles. He talks about those that come in to your assembly that are outsiders. He certainly doesn't say that you ought to ban them. But on a certain level, Jim, and certainly this isn't characteristic of all of the emergent movement, but on a certain level, there are some who almost give the impression that that the Christian faith is something that you kind of blend into that. And again, I'm not so convinced that there has to be a defining moment of conversion. I mean, Paul said, I was separated from my mother's womb to preach the gospel. So did his conversion experience really happen on the road to Damascus? So, you know, the evangelical litmus test of pray this prayer, sign this card, I kind of push against that. And I'm probably with a lot of emergence in that regard. But at the same time, I hesitate to say, how long do you let an unbeliever who is not willing to to conform to the faith once for all delivered to the saints. You know, what is the where do you draw the line to say you can no longer be a part of this fellowship? I mean,
that's a great question, and not even it's one that we ask at Redeemer, and I'm not sure we have an answer. But what we've done to this point is everything is more of a case by case, because every person is different. Everybody's journey takes a little longer. Some we're more, you're patient with it, takes longer. Some people, it's a couple months and they're of hanging around and they're believing. Some people just after a few months realize that as they're being enticed to the well, they don't want to come and they'll leave and we'll say goodbye with sadness. I think it's different for every person, but the key thing is, and I think this is where some of the emerging churches might struggle, is the belief that somehow just by being there for a long period of time and learning the ways of Jesus, that they're actually going to believe in Jesus. I think there is a moment where every soul says, and it may take a while, where they say, I believe in Christ, in what he's done for me, and the death, the life he lived, the death he died, the resurrection he experienced on my behalf. And it's to that that I have my hope. And I think there comes a moment where everybody, every believer, realizes that God has, the hound of heaven has chased them down, and they now believe. And they're not just acting like a believer, but they're actually believing like a believer. And that has to come. And I think there's a little bit of clarity maybe on the emerging side to say, does that have to happen, and when does that happen? Because Christianity is more than social action, it's more than justice, it's more than mercy. My goodness, of course those are part of who we are and how the gospel changes us into those kind of generous people. But it's also, it's a belief what God has done on our behalf that saves us.
Yeah, it comes down to the question Jesus asked the Pharisees, what do you more than others? I mean, it seems to me that, Jesus said, except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no case enter the kingdom.
Yeah.
And so there's more to it than just social justice, although I'll be quick to say, as one sitting high atop the traditional church world, social justice has been quite a vacuum in many of our churches. That, and in that regard, we can learn from the emerging church. One of the things that the emerging church seems to have an aversion to is structure. I mean, you hear Brian McLaren, you quoted him earlier, Jim, saying, look, I don't propose that I speak for all emergents. And they have done their best to try not to become a denomination or an organization, very loosely structured. Mm-hmm. How does Deep Church do leadership structure on the local church level in terms of, the authoritative structure in the local assembly?
Yeah, there's been a huge pushback from the emergents against the traditional and even the seeker world. If they would, I don't talk about this much in the book, but they would push back against the mega church model and the business model and how everything's structured around business. They would push back on the traditional, more of the hierarchical, almost administrative model that's in the major denominations, and they think that it stultifies and really kills ministry and shepherding, and pastors are spending all of their time in meetings and that sort of thing. So there's a real pushback to move towards more leaderless groups, less hierarchy, less structure. And when I first started my church our church, Redeemer, I was just coming off a staff at a 5,000 member, very large church that was more in the traditional side but had a contemporary service. And I saw the bureaucracy and I saw the structure. And so when we were small and organic, I thought, wow, this is the way we want to be. But even as we grew and got to around 100 in those early years, people started getting really frustrated with my lack of structure and my kind of organic desire just to do ministry. And people get hurt sometimes. And there's not, you don't know what to expect when there's not some structure. So the third way really is to say, look, yes, we want organic ministry and we want the spirit to move, but any time a group gets together, there is structure. It doesn't matter. The question is it a good structure and does it support mission, or does it get in the way of mission? And so we always want to say, yes, we're going to need structure in a church and we're going to need a plan for ministry, but the goal is, is it helping us to become more missional? I think when it starts getting in the way of mission and what the church is supposed to be, then it needs to be reformed and it needs to be changed. But for us just to throw out 2,000 years of wisdom on how to structure a church and how to, you know, whether it's deacons and elders and the different ministries that we have, those what I call in the book the kind of inherited wisdom of the past, the inherited structures of the past, I think that gets us into trouble.
Yeah, I think in many ways, some, not all, but some in the, and certainly earlier this was more true than it is now, I think, but the emerging church bucked against not only structure but church history and the notion that really it is the postmodern context that defines what the church is, and kind of pushed aside the whole notion of, you know, let's not do things the way Calvin did it or Luther did it. That was fine for their generation, but that kind of structure isn't fine for ours. We're in a postmodern context, and we've got to shape things our way. And I keep coming back to Jesus saying, I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. You know, how much liberty do we have to shape the church in the image we think is best to reach the culture in terms of really moving outside of the preconditions of Scripture as to the irreducible minimums of what a church is to be and do.
Right. Yeah. You know, what's so interesting is that with my emerging friends is they, it's kind of, they're postmodern in that sense that they don't want to be tied to the authority of the history of the past. I mean, that's postmodernism. Okay. I mean, that's partly what it did was to knock that scaffolding down. But at the same time, like postmodernism, they tend to be eclectic, bringing in things from the past. And I welcome some of the things. You know, some of them are rediscovering the Lord's Supper. Some of them are rediscovering contemplative prayer or things from, or even liturgy from the past. I welcome all that. My critique and it is, The difficulty, well, here's my critique, is that I say to them, look, I'm glad you love the fruit from the history of the church. That's great. But what I would love for you to do is also adopt the roots from which it comes, the trunk of the tree, you know, that sort of thing. And because my fear is that it just becomes trendy.
Yeah.
And I think if the church is going to recover its depth, it needs to go all the way back and plant itself deeply into the great tradition, going all the way back to the beginning, but certainly mediated through the 4th and 5th century, the creeds, what we talk about, deep church and mere Christianity, because it's from the history of the church that we learn and have so much wisdom. And this is something I tried to bring up in my book, is I really believe that those who are the most keyed into the history of the church are actually the most relevant to the modern times. Mm. It's kind of ironic that the people who often have the greatest understanding of the past understand how to interact with the present and the future. And I think we make a great mistake. I think the boomers did this with the megachurch by throwing out all tradition. But I think the emerging guys and gals will make a similar mistake if they don't. And the nice thing is that a lot of them are going back and rediscovering the church fathers and rediscovering the history of our past all the way up through the Reformation up to the present and saying, hey, we've got to be tied into this because this is the taproot. This is where the strength comes from. And it's also the thing that doesn't allow us to get caught up in kind of the whims of the day. We all like to think we're biblical. We all like to think we're interpreting scriptures properly. But it's really the great tradition that kind of becomes the benchmark and says, you know what, this has been tried before, and you know where it ended? Mm. It didn't end good.
Mm. Yeah.
It didn't end in a good way. And so by kind of trying to recreate out of whole cloth, I think we put ourselves at a disadvantage.
Jim Belcher, my guest, Deep Church, the book, A Third Way Beyond Emerging and Traditional, the website www.thedeepchurch.com. We'll continue our conversation with Jim Belcher. I encourage you to get this book. It's an excellent contribution to the conversation on the emerging church versus the traditional church. 866-423-WLQV is our phone number if you'd like to engage. And let me remind you, we need 10,000 Bibles for our brothers and sisters in Southeast Asia. We're at about 5,200 right now. Actually 5,500 on our way to 6,000 today. An $80 gift will send 20 Bibles. A $4 gift sends one. Just give. It's not what you give, it's that you give. 1-800-YES-WORD, 1-800-937-9673.
Why do I go to crosswalk.com? The best Bible study tools on the internet, and they're free.
The biggest Christian chats and forums on the web.
I love the daily devotionals.
Movie reviews I can trust.
Great articles on marriage and parenting.
The latest news and reviews on Christian books and music.
A great Christian single section.
News and commentary from a Christian perspective.
Why do I go to crosswalk.com?
Why do I go to crosswalk.com?
Why do I go to crosswalk.com?
Crosswalk.com, the intersection of faith and life. Why do you go?
Is your computer running slowly? Thinking about buying a new one? Don't waste your money. Your computer could be infected with spyware, malware, viruses, registry errors, spam, and pop-ups. You don't need to buy a new computer. Just go to DoubleMySpeed.com and find out what's slowing your computer down.
Double My Speed totally cleaned up my system and increased my speed.
DoubleMySpeed.com increased the speed of my computer from the very first day.
My computer was on its last leg. Now it's like new again.
Get your free diagnosis at DoubleMySpeed.com and keep your computer running fast. Your free diagnosis at DoubleMySpeed.com is easy and fast.
It's the best you could ask for. Outstanding, and my computer is running faster than ever.
Find out what is slowing down your computer with a free diagnosis at DoubleMySpeed.com. Don't waste your time with your slow computer. Get your free diagnosis now at DoubleMySpeed.com. That's DoubleMySpeed.com.
This is Pastor David Washington asking you to join us on Transform Lives Ministry, airing every day, Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. You can also get more information about us at tlministries.net, tlministries.net. And this radio broadcast is going to be where the Word of God will absolutely change and transform your life.
Join Pastor David Washington Jr. for Transform Lives, weekdays at 11 a.m. here on AM 1500 WLQV.com.
The Paul Edwards Program, 866-423-WLQV is our phone number to engage, 866-423-9578 here in the Center for the Study of God and Culture, where you can send us an instant message at godandculture.com, talking with Jim Belcher about his book, Deep Church, A Third Way Beyond Emerging and Traditional. Jim is founding church planter, lead pastor at Redeemer Presbyterian Church in Newport Beach, California, and his website, www.thedeepchurch.com, taking your phone calls for Jim at 866-423-WLQV. Brian in Northville. Welcome, Brian. You're on the Paul Edwards Program with Jim Belcher.
Hi, Paul. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hope you're feeling better.
Thank you very much.
Interesting conversation. I'm a pretty big John MacArthur follower. I've listened to a lot of different preachers of the word, and I mean, for me, John's just right on. I mean, just, I don't know, I just can't see it any different anymore after listening to him. But I guess my question is, why are we questioning how to I mean, people haven't changed for 2,000 years, right? I mean, the same issues that people dealt with, the same sins that human beings dealt with 2,000 years ago are the same today. You know, God's word is everlasting and never really changes. And I guess I don't know why we're considering tailoring any church around trying to entice. I mean, we keep saying postmodern, but what grabbed people 2,000 years ago to come follow Jesus would work today. And I just don't see why we're considering changing or doing anything different than the church structure and the commandments laid out in the New Testament.
Brian, it's a great point, Jim. You know, Jesus said you're pouring new wine into old wineskins. What of this notion of, you know, changing to meet the culture when sinners are sinners are sinners are sinners, regardless of what century they live in, and shouldn't the gospel be enough?
Well, I certainly don't disagree with Brian that human nature hasn't really changed, and our sinful human nature hasn't changed, and our need for the gospel and that message. But I think going all the way back, even to the book of Acts, you see the message being tailored differently in the early church, whether it's Matthew in the presentation he makes in his gospel versus John versus Mark or Luke. The gospel has always been contextualized into different languages and different cultures. And I think that's what's interesting about even the people, how God called the different apostles to go into different regions. Some of them went into certain regions because they were the right person who could speak the language and contextualize the gospel in a way. So nobody, I don't think we're calling for a change in the gospel message, but I think in every generation, in every culture, the gospel has to be communicated in a way, and this is what missionaries do all the time when they contextualize, has to be communicated in a way that the people can hear it and hear it clearly. And that's really all I'm calling for.
Where, Jim, is the chasm the broadest, the division between the emerging and traditional camps? Is it soteriology? Is it the atonement debate? Is it ecclesiology? Is it how we structure ministry? Of these seven areas of protest that you point out and you deal with from both sides, emerging and traditional, where do you think the gap is the widest between the two camps?
Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly the ones that have gotten the most, generate the most heat and pushback would be the chapter I deal with the gospel or atonement questions and then the postmodern questions. I think the one that is probably generating the most heat and conversation now is the gospel question, the atonement, and how broad is the atonement, what parts of the atonement are being accepted. And I think that's a really important, obviously an extremely important point for that whole understanding of deep church. Can we be mere Christians together? Do we hold enough to the same vision of the gospel? And I think that's probably the most important concept or doctrine that we're talking about here.
Who would you point to on either side that best represents the positions of each camp? Is it MacArthur on the traditional side? Is it McLaren or Scott McKnight or somebody on the emerging side? In all the research that you did in looking at both sides, is there, you think of Peter, James, and John. Is there a Peter that kind of comes out for both groups?
In my book, I look at Brian McLaren's view and his view of the kingdom, and I interact with him because I think he's probably still the most winsome, the best writer and presenter of kind of the emerging side of things on that, and really stressing the kingdom part. So I look at him, and as far as the pushback, MacArthur, but I think the one that's doing the most work right now is John Piper, without a doubt, on issues of atonement, and particularly how he has interacted with N.T. Wright.
Yep.
Now, there are people on all sides of the spectrum in the dialogue who appreciate N.T. Wright. But I think there's a lot in the emerging camp as well. So I would say probably Piper. Those would be the two. And Scott, to me, Scott McKnight, and Scott's a friend of mine. I think Scott's more of a middle ground. I think he's really working hard to find a third way when it comes to atonement. And I really appreciate a lot of what he's written on this.
I'll tell you, N.T. Wright, for all of the all of the pushback he gets from traditionals like me on the issue of the new perspectives, reading his most recent book on the resurrection changed the way I lead funeral services.
Wow. How so?
Oh, my goodness. The whole notion of this is it, folks. We've been waiting. You know, most evangelical funeral services for a Christian go to this extreme of saying, isn't it wonderful that God has delivered this person from his body? And after reading Wright's work on the resurrection, coming to the biblical conclusion that God actually made you to be in a body, and that death is robbery, death is a thief, it's an enemy, and it shouldn't be welcomed under any circumstances. I'll tell you, it's just changed my whole perspective on funerals.
Yeah, and surprise, you are going to get a new resurrected body and live in the new heavens and the earth.
Yeah,
is what he's saying. Yeah, it is. There, that's what. As much, there's things about N.T. Wright that I may disagree with, I'm sure. He's such a brilliant theologian, but I have been amazingly blessed by his writings and tremendous stuff. That's what I always want to tell people, is that even with the people we disagree with, we can learn from them. We can learn from even people we may disagree 80%. There's still things that we can learn from people, and what my book is trying to do is take away some of the fear, kind of demystify some of the debate, so that we can just sit and dialogue and listen. But I'm not calling for a kumbaya moment. There are still hard questions to ask, and there's going to be differences. but I want it to be done in a whole kind of a whole different tone or spirit, because I think that's what's best for the unity of the church and how we look to the outside world looking in. I mean, I think the world looks in and says, "Gosh, these Christians aren't very nice to each other. They're not going to be nice to me."
Yeah,
you know. And I think we have a call to be kind to one another, even when we disagree.
I couldn't agree more. Jim Belcher, the book Deep Church: A Third Way Beyond Emerging and Traditional. Learn about the book and pick it up at www.thedeepchurch.com. Jim, it's been a great conversation.
Oh, fantastic! Thanks so much, Paul.
Are you losing your home to foreclosure? Are you behind on your mortgage and fear the worst? The law firm of Pomeroy & Associates would like to offer you a free, no-obligation consultation that will show you how to stop foreclosure, reduce your interest rate, and save thousands on your mortgage. Do not let this economic slowdown take your home from you and your family. You have worked too hard. Pomeroy & Associates is an attorney-based loan modification firm that can negotiate the terms of your mortgage so you can afford to live in and enjoy your home. Call for a free, no-obligation consultation. There is no cost to find out how this program can help you save your home. Call 800-656-0043. That's 800-656-0043. It does not matter how far behind you are on your payment or whatever your credit score is. Pomeroy & Associates is here to listen and help. Call now, 800-656-0043. 800-656-0043.
Are you tired of paying $100 an hour for computer support just for the prompt to return? Hi, I'm Luke Ford, founder and CEO of My Computer Works. Whenever you have a major computer catastrophe or a simple question, give my U.S.-based computer technicians a call, and they'll remotely connect your computer and fix the problem for you. It's safe, secure, and you won't have to let a stranger into your home. Call now to receive 1 month of service free with a membership. Now let's hear from some of our satisfied customers.
They cleaned up the computer and I sat there and watched everything going on. I was just having a ball.
So the convenience of having My Computer Works connect to my computer right then, fix it for me immediately, is priceless.
I was having a lot of major problems with my computer, and they basically evaluated the computer and went through and eliminated the problems I was having.
The number to call is 800-466-1849. That's 800-466-1849. Toll free, 800-466-1849.
My Computer Works. Does yours?
800-466-1849.
When my son started having behavior problems, the total transformation techniques were like the instruction manual on how to deal with him. We got immediate results.
Ever wish your kid came with an instruction manual? When he's disrespectful, defiant, or even abusive? Do you know how to fix it? I'm behavioral therapist James Lehman, and I'll show you how to change your child's behavior right now with the Total Transformation, the program that helps you fix every behavior problem under the sun. Defiance, backtalking, lying, acting out in school, even problems with ADD and ADHD. There's no screaming, no fighting, no frustration. The Total Transformation is the program I've used for over 30 years to solve even the worst behavior problems. Your child will listen to you again, and you'll get peace and sanity back into your home. I guarantee it.
Call now and get How to Turn Your Child's Attitude Around in 1 minute or less free with your order. Call 1-800-430-3961. 1-800-430-3961. Call now. 1-800-430-3961.
I want to thank Pastor Emery Moss Jr. for sitting in the seat yesterday, the Augustine of Hippo chair. I came down with the stomach flu late the night before and went to my doctor, and I would appreciate your prayers. You need to know that well, you probably don't need to know this, but I'll since you're a loyal listening audience, I'll share it with you anyway. When I went to Senegal a year ago with Bible League, about 4 days into that trip, I got very, very ill, as you will recall. Me sharing that with you, and I related the story of how on a Sunday they all prayed for me, and by Sunday evening I was well again, miraculously was able to finish out the trip and had no other problems. However, I have been under doctor's treatment for the last year, and they have in the last several months they have determined that I picked up some sort of amoeba or some sort of bug in Senegal, West Africa, that has affected my intestinal tract and has contributed to a lot of stomach issues. So, you know, normally if I'm off the air, number one, it's probably church related. I'm out doing the Lord's work. Number two, it is probably related to this amoeba thing that I got going on that the doctors are trying to get figured out. And that's part of what was happening yesterday. So I never like to be away from the microphone, and I always appreciate your understanding, but I always appreciate having good guys like Emory Moss Jr. at the ready to come sit at the microphone. But I would covet your prayers for me as over the next month, I'm going to continue to go through some tests to figure out exactly how to get rid of this thing. So we serve a sovereign God, and I'm excited for what God is going to do in my body, whether by life or by death, not that I'm going to die. Hey, join me sending Bibles, will you? $80 sends $24 sends one. We need 10,000. We're at 6,000. 1-800-YES-WORD. Make the call now.
Yo, where'd everybody go?
Individual results may vary. Program not available in all states. See contract for complete terms.
If your credit card debt is out of control, if you're in over your head dealing with monthly payments, there is powerful information you need to know about the government's bailout of credit card companies. If you have more than $10,000 in credit card debt, you have the right to settle that debt for a fraction of what you owe with monthly payments you can afford. Credit card companies have been given billions and need to clean their books once and for all. And that's great news for you. We're Credit Answers, and we'd like to offer you free information that will show you how to settle your credit card debt with payment plans customized for you. It's yours free by calling 1-800-410-2703. Don't declare bankruptcy. Give us 10 minutes and learn how we have saved our clients millions. Live better, debt-free. For free information on how to settle your credit card debt in a government bailout era, call 1-800-410-2703. That's 1-800-410-2703.